Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, Thursday afternoon, March 2nd now. And Dennis Rodkin joins us from time to time on Thursdays to talk about real estate in the Chicago area, writes for Crane Chicago Business. He's here now. Dennis, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so I'm just jumping right in because you always have so many different things to talk about. And the one I talked with Bill and Wendy about in a little crosstalk a few minutes ago was the fact that the number of small the number of small non-residential home buyers.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
was skyrocketed up 10%. Did it in a way that wasn't spread. Explain this for me.
Nobody really expected to see that. Nobody saw this coming. One out of four homes in the Chicago area sold last year was sold to a, as you said, a non-resident small investor. What that means is somebody who doesn't plan to move in, but also somebody who isn't a big institutional investor from a bank.
We've talked about the big buyers.
That was going on quite a bit in 2012, 13, 14. It's still happening, but at a much smaller rate. Now what you're seeing is the great majority of these homes are bought by people who have a portfolio of one or two properties. It may be an affluent couple who want to put some money into real estate as opposed to the stock market or some other vehicle they might put it in. They're buying them to rent it. They're buying them to flip it. They might be buying, this category includes second homes, which of course is not anything new. But one out of four homes sold last year went to a small investor who doesn't plan to live there.
So it helped me because the interest rates are still very low. So that makes it more attractive.
Right.
But the prices, Chicago has sort of lagged behind the country, right?
Right.
So that makes it more affordable here.
Yeah. It's a low cost investment. Down payments, our prices are very low and you can put down a small down payment, which becomes smaller because our prices are low. Interest rates are low. So if you want to do sort of a buy and hold strategy, you buy, you rent it out. Most of these, as far as we can tell, are buying to rent, not to flip. You buy it, you hold on to it for a while and rent it out, and you expect that the appreciation, the market is really starting to heat up now.
Right.
So buy now, buy in 2016, and within the near future, it rises enough that it becomes a very profitable investment while having brought you in passive income as a rental.
So we talked about why our numbers are a little more attractive here. How do the Chicago numbers, as far as the percentages, compare nationwide?
Nationwide, it's up to 30. It's an amazing figure. It's 37%, while 26% here. But that 26%, 26.1% of purchases last year, is up from 10% a decade ago. So in 2006...
More than doubled.
Yeah. Well, yeah. 2006, one out of 10 homes, or 10%, sold to a small investor. 2016, 26%, about one out of four.
Okay, so I think you said that most of these are people who are going to rent the place
right
out. So, because we hear the commercials. Actually, my brother-in-law flips houses.
Yeah.
In out west, but those aren't so much what we're talking about.
Flippers,
or is it just a little bit of everything?
It's a little bit of everything. It's sort of a grab bag. Flippers are still about 4, 5, 6% of all sales. So if you think of this 26%, I don't know the figure that is second homes, and we also don't know the sort of unknown group. But it looks like, 10, 15, 20% might be people who are doing it for rental.
You write in your piece that there might be fewer next year, will be slimmer.
Prices are going up around here. A lot more people have gotten involved. And because prices are going up, sellers may be less likely to go for that investor buyer. They may say, no, I'm going to hold on.
Right.
Because a homeowner typically pays more. A homeowner has an emotional as well as a financial investment when buying and typically is going to pay more than an investor will. So with our market heating up, sellers may be saying, no, I don't need you. I can wait because a homeowner will come
along.
And
as our markets heat up, the number of foreclosures is down dramatically last month.
Hugely. Yeah. So winter was, for the past 4 or 5 years, in the winter, the share of our sales that was foreclosures would grow. Pretty simple. People who are buying, homeowners who are buying, aren't as likely to buy in the winter. So they're moving out of the market. So the number of foreclosures, even if it doesn't change, takes a bigger share. But our share of foreclosures peaked, foreclosures as a share of all sales peaked in February 2012 at 44% of all sales.
Wow.
In January this year, it was 11% of all sales. And the other thing is, it was fewer than 1,000 sales. We've had 5 months in a row of fewer than 1,000 sales that were foreclosures after 7 years when that figure was over 1,000 and was up in the 4,000 and 5,000.
So it's behind us. until all these people are buying their second and third homes.
Exactly. The two are related. A lot of flippers are buying foreclosures. We're also, we've had 10 years to heal. A lot of the foreclosure inventory has been burned off over the years. The banks have tried to sort of get those properties out onto the market. They were having trouble in the first few years figuring out how to do it. So altogether, we're starting to see that foreclosure inventory sort of move into the rearview mirror.
So we've talked from time to time about home selling seasons, right?
Yeah.
And that it sort of begins after the Super Bowl.
Right.
And then going through this winter, we also talked, or you talked about, I listened, about how December and January were pretty hot anyway.
Yeah.
So have we had a season opening, or we're just kind of maintaining where we were?
You know, it really started right after the election, and we haven't seen it die down yet. Have we sort of cannibalized what would come a few months later? Of course, we won't know until a few months later has elapsed, but it doesn't show any sign of slowing down. So it appears that we're on a run since the election that may continue for quite a while, and the Super Bowl will have passed us by, the beginning of spring will have passed us by, and we'll continue the pace that it's been at.
So all of that, we're talking about affordability, interest rates, and home prices and all of that. Another piece that you wrote, I think it was just last week or so, is about the percentage of what homeowners spend on their mortgage. 14.6% of the household income on their mortgage. That's if you're a homeowner.
Right.
The average from 85 to 2000 was 22.8. So what, down 8% there?
8 percentage points,
10%.
Yeah.
That's because of the mortgage rates being dropped?
Well, it's both. It's mortgage rates are so much lower. You know, I don't know when you bought your first house, Steve, but when people were buying houses in the 80s, paying 15% interest.
I think I paid 11%, and that would have been, that would have been the late 80s. Yeah.
And somebody probably said to you, isn't this great? Rates are all the way down to 11
right.
now. And they've, of course, for the past 10 years, they've been down below 5%. It's just been an amazing period. So that's one reason. The other is that our prices have been so low for the past several years.
I don't know why. I'm not surprised by this when I think about it. But rent, so if a homeowner pays 14.6% of their household income on mortgages, renters spend 29.8%.
That's what the data says. Yeah, part of that is that we've got this luxury rental community, or this flock of luxury rentals in Chicago. We've got millennials who are making a lot of money, who are in tech fields, things like that, who go ahead and take the luxury apartment. They may a few years down the line say, yeah, I don't need all those amenities, I don't need all that stuff, but they are at the moment paying for these super fancy rentals that have been built all over town.
So,
and that brings up the average.
Just so you know, you're sitting with genius.
Yeah.
As I said 30 seconds ago, I said it didn't make sense until I thought about it.
Yeah.
I thought about it, and that's not what I came up with at all.
Oh, what did you come up with?
Well, I thought maybe that it was that renters tended to be lower income. So they had less money, so it took up a bigger share.
That's a piece of it as well.
Yeah, but more likely the expert says it's the high-end renting.
I think if you look at both the bottom and the top, they are both affecting the average in that.
I'm pretty happy where I live right now. I really love my neighborhood. My house is fine.
As you've said, you're a genius.
And I'm a genius. Right. But I think the only thing that could get me to move would be if I could find a building that changed colors.
Well, have I got a building for you.
During the day. What? Tell me about this. Where is this? Uptown? No, not uptown. Where is it? Ukrainian Village. Okay.
It's a condo building that has been, construction hasn't begun yet. Marketing starts soon. Groundbreaking is later this year. And it's going to be wrapped in metal. It's a pretty interesting, I think what we're seeing is a lot of the real sort of sharp projects that people were hoping to do. They're now rolling out. I have another one today, a house that has two sets of stripes on the front, five stories high in the Old Town. But this one you're talking about is, often condo buildings are wrapped in brick, that sort of thing. This has metal siding. It's all insulated.
So it reflects?
How does it change color? Well,
it's
not a shiny finish. It's a matte finish. So as the light changes, the color of the building will change. Your perception of the color of the building
right,
will change. The
right.
building doesn't actually change. And it sort of fits into a cool neighborhood, Ukrainian Village. But one thing to keep in mind, somebody commented on the story when I first posted it, oh, it's going to be like living in a tin can. The metal is the outer layer of construction. There's insulation and everything else. So you shouldn't hear rain pounding on the side of the building any more than you would in any other building.
Unless you have your windows open.
Unless you have your, well, that, yeah.
Well, no, I'm going to have my windows open, so I would think I'm going to hear it. And $549,000 to $768,000?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to say.
Those are Ukrainian village prices.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll probably have to save up then before I move out of my house. Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business. Read much more about this at chicagobusiness.com. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Steve.
It's 12:22. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Well, Bill, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good to be here, sir. How are you?
Good. Okay, let's just say from at the outset, you were sitting here two weeks ago.
Yeah.
When Donald Trump had the big mammoth news conference. And you had to get bumped. I enjoyed my time sitting with you, but sorry about
we
that.
We listened to Trump together, right?
Yeah. Okay, so the Dow is down today, 60 points or so.
Right. After being up 300 and over 300 yesterday.
Holy moly,
how about
right?
That?
I mean,
yeah.
Things just keep going up.
They do.
So I would imagine, I don't know. So it must be, this is one of the challenges, I think, for advisors like you, because, you know, people say this, they look the you know, the sky's the limit. I want to get into this. I might be getting close to retirement, but it's just so tempting to see this keep going up like that.
Yeah, and you know the problem is when the market's going up, people lose track of how much risk they have in their portfolio. If they really had a handle on it, and we're finding a lot of people coming in to see us have a lot more risk in their portfolio and they realize what they really should have at this stage of their life.
So, and I want to get to that about different stages and where you should be, but it's also, I think, you know, I mean, this can't last forever, right? So maybe buying into the market now is not a great idea anyway.
We don't know.
You think it can last forever?
Well, not forever. We just don't know when the next big downturn is going to be.
Right.
Could be a year from now, it could be tomorrow, it could be 5 years from now. We don't know that.
Right. And I mean, it's certainly encouraging right now. And the things the president has said he wants to do are encouraging for people who invest in Wall Street. And, you know, everyone's 401k. If you have a 401k, is better for it.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you're heading toward retirement or if you're preparing for retirement, one of the things that you talk about is important is to sort of figure out where you are. I mean, look at how old you are, when you're going to retire, and don't, if you're 60, don't be investing like you're a 30-year-old.
Yeah, and that's an issue because we're seeing people, as I just said, with a lot more risk than what they should have. A couple weeks ago, we had a 60-year-old couple come into our office. They're planning on retiring in 5 years. They told me that they're a conservative investors. And that they really don't want any big losses at this stage
sure.
of their life. And that's consistent with who we see and who we specialize in. So what we did is we did a stress test on their portfolio. You know what a stress test is for your heart, right?
Yeah, I do.
You're on a treadmill and they put your heart under stress. Well, we have a couple of very sophisticated pieces of software that we put the folks' portfolio in it and we do a stress test on their portfolio. And the stress test came back for this couple that the next big downturn, and again, we don't know when that's going to be, but the next big downturn, they're going to lose 40 to 45% of their portfolio at 60 years old.
So did they come into you saying they were conservative and didn't have a conservative portfolio?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Their portfolio looked more like a 30-year-old's than a 60-year-old's.
How often does that happen?
Way too often.
I would think so, yeah.
Way too often. And in a rising market, people and their advisors lose track of just the fact that things can go down too.
Right.
And if you're at that age, your number one goal, most folks' number one goal is to protect what they have, not have any big losses, still grow their portfolio conservatively, but then start creating income for the retirement too.
It takes some discipline though, doesn't it? If you see the numbers for the 30-year-olds keep going up, you know, to step back and say, well, that's not quite where I need to be because of where I am right now.
You can still have good growth and invest conservatively. That's kind of a misconception. I'm talking about you're not swinging for the fences on every pitch.
Right, right.
You know, if you think about it, at 60 years old, you probably have a bigger portfolio than you've ever had in your entire life. Just kind of makes sense,
sure,
right?
Sure, right.
And at that stage, maybe 5 years from retirement, the last thing that you want to do is have a big loss.
How do you figure out how conservative or how swinging for the fences you are with your portfolio?
Well, that's part of what we do for folks. We do the stress test. We want to understand just how much risk they have as a basis for a conversation going forward about how to prepare for retirement. But the first step is understanding just that. How much risk do they have? What their portfolio is costing them? What kind of growth potential there is? And to do, you know, an analysis right at the beginning.
Bill Geiger, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, sir.
We'll see you in a few weeks, right?
We'll see you then.
All right, Kim Gordon, Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much, Kim. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Ian Schur is on a phone line. He writes for CNET, and we talked to him from time to time about some of the developments in the world of technology. I guess, Ian, have you purchased your Snap stocks yet?
I'm not allowed to as a reporter, but everyone else seems to be. The stock is doing really well. Which is an interesting thing when you're a financial reporter. The stock pops on its first day. It's considered a good thing, but it means also that the company was undervalued when it was priced the day before, and so the company didn't make as much money. So it's kind of a mix of result, but definitely the people who own the stock are very happy right now.
Well, and sometimes when they pop on the first day, right, they drop on the second.
Well, yes, and that can happen, and in fact, when there have been situations with people like Facebook, you know, the stock may stay pretty even for the first day, which we learned later some of the banks were buying stock to keep it even for the first day and make that look good, and then it dropped afterward.
Right.
And there are things like, you know, the employees are allowed to sell after a few months. That could cause the stock to go down, all sorts of stuff like that.
And but you, as an erstwhile and an ethical reporter, you're just going to watch from the sidelines.
That's what I do best, yes.
All right, well, if you have any other tips, you can give them to me because I am not watching from the sidelines.
I'll keep that in mind.
I'm interested in, you know, we've talked from time to time about virtual reality and all of that. And I was in a Microsoft store over the holidays where they were trying it out. And I kind of wanted to do it, but there's some other guy looking like a goof ahead of me. So I didn't take advantage of it. But there's a piece in CNET about how Snapchat or Snap could actually be an introduction to augmented reality? Explain that for me.
Yeah, so there are two different technologies that we're talking about. One is virtual reality, where they take a screen, put it really close to your face, and it actually makes your brain be convinced that you're in this computer-generated world. You're actually tricked into it. Whereas with augmented reality, or AR, what it does is it overlays computer images on the real world. So an example you may have had was playing Pokemon Go over the last summer. You would look through your camera, right, on your phone, and suddenly a Pokemon would show up in the real world. That's augmented reality. And in fact, most of the people who are technology experts and the experts in the room and analysts believe that augmented reality is going to be the real seller over the next few years, and that it is the thing that everyone's going to want to use.
And so and Snapchat will be in a position to do that with their spectacles.
Yes, and that's the interesting thing. Like Snapchat has these glasses where they put the cameras on. And what's interesting is that they have a lot of the pieces already there. For example, you know, if you have a teenager nearby, ask them to do this. They have this thing called lenses where it'll change what you look like on the picture automatically as you're using it. And so a lot of this stuff has become pretty popular. And it's an example of how you can marry computer images in the real world in a way that's very entertaining, and it's just the start of showing how people can get comfortable with this. And eventually people think we'll be working this way. We won't have computer screens anymore. We'll just put on glasses that show us the computer images in front of us.
Okay,
so this is the first steps to that.
You gently corrected me because I do confuse these all the time, augmented reality as opposed to virtual reality. They share the term reality, but the two, by definition, aren't going to marry, right? They're always going to be sort of separate.
Well, that's what we think. But in fact, people like Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, right, the CEO of Facebook, he bought one of the most high-profile VR companies, Oculus, He has said that he believes this stuff will marry eventually. And what will happen, you know, we don't know how it'll look, but one example could be that you have a pair of glasses that turn dark and show you, you know, they suddenly become the virtual world. And then you can have normal glasses and see, you know, computer images on top. We don't know what it's going to be like, but the expectation is that we're going to live in a world where this stuff is very interchangeable.
So,
and there's actually a new term for that. So you've got virtual reality, augmented reality. There's another one called mixed reality, where it's kind of all-encompassing of all of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to write that down, but it's not going to stay with me. I've only got room for two. Do you see a time? I mean, so if you look way out into the future, maybe not so far way out, to where we're always walking around with some sort of filter on our face, so we're never really seeing truly the naked outside. We're always seeing it enhanced or augmented in one way or another.
Yeah, it can get dystopian pretty quick, right? So
yeah.
There's definitely that concern, and something that I believe that there's going to be a cultural conversation at some point around this stuff. And, you know, we're having that conversation right now, by the way, with texting. And we're going to start having that conversation, I think, with social media, as the kids who are, you know, who were born when Facebook was created are growing up and starting to have their real lives, and they find out their entire lives were documented on Facebook. I think that those conversations need to happen. And what's likely to happen is that the technology will come out first. We will see these kind of horror stories, just like we did before, about sexting and privacy concerns and robbers who were looking for people who would post about how they're away from the weekend and stuff like that. We'll have that, the equivalent of that stuff happening with virtual reality and augmented reality, and then we'll talk about it.
Have we ever gone back with something? I mean, has ever something, because I'm thinking now as you describe this, like, wow, I had that reaction in the 80s with the Walkman. I'm thinking,
right,
here are these people walking around with headphones on, you know, and I don't think we ever go back.
No, we don't go back that much. But what we do try to do is we try to be more thoughtful. And that's really what I see more often. For example, you see laws being put in place all around the country around using your phone in the car. In fact, where I am in California, we passed a second law just recently around it because the first law didn't cover enough stuff. And so that's something where there is reaction to it. And we're saying, okay, well, you can use this stuff and it can be part of your life, but you need to be very segmented in how you do it.
All right, so
I think that's what's going to ultimately happen.
Augmented reality to mixed reality and now to the virtual reality. You mentioned earlier Zuckerberg and Oculus Rift. And, you know, I talked about trying those. I didn't try them on. I kind of wanted to do it. But they're dropping the price now for Oculus Rift, right? Is it the fact that no one's buying them?
Well, we don't know. That's the hard part. So we do know that Sony, which makes the PlayStation, and they make their own version of virtual reality called PlayStation VR, a very original name. They sold just under 1 million units as of mid-February, and it came out in, I believe, October or November. So that is one data point. Now, when you think about how the iPhone sells nearly 50 million or more than 40 million inside of 3 months, you say 1 million virtual reality headsets is nothing. But we don't know how large this market is or how large it'll get. And so looking at that and then seeing Oculus drop its price by effectively $200 tells us that this market may not be moving as fast as they think. And Mark Zuckerberg has said, the CEO of Facebook has said, that he is willing to invest up to $3 billion over the next decade to make VR be a thing. And that could be subsidizing these devices.
My idea of virtual reality right now is like buying a CD player again, if I may go back in the Wayback Machine, before all the albums were coming out on CD. You know, that's what I'm thinking. Why would I go spend $500 on a headset when it's fairly limited what I can do with it? A lot of what I want to do isn't available yet in virtual reality. Am I wrong in assuming that, or is that part of the whole thing?
No, you're not wrong. In fact, the number one conversation happening this week in San Francisco during what's called the Game Developers Conference, it's the largest conference of its kind that happens every year. Everyone I've talked to has said content is a problem. How many games are there? Are there enough compelling games? Are there enough compelling entertainment experiences? Is there enough other stuff to make people want to get this? And the reality is that it's not, or at least not enough to convince them to put down $600 to get one. And so that's a big problem. Also, cost is a big problem. these headsets are, I just said, you know, you're talking about $600. That doesn't include the $1,000 computer to make them work.
Do you need hand mechanisms as well?
Well, it's turning into that. So okay. Facebook, when they dropped the price, they basically, what they did is that they made it so that the hand mechanisms are part of it. And so what's happening is that it's becoming a thing where basically you use you're going to want to have hand controllers in virtual reality. And even Google, who sells that Daydream headset you might have seen in Best Buy, which is the one that uses a phone, right?
Right.
They have a little wand that you use. So it seems like everyone's kind of getting in some direction of you want to have a motion controller, kind of like the Nintendo Wii was a decade ago, to work in virtual reality. And that's part of why you saw this price drop, right? You're asking people to spend $700 feels even more crazy. So they're at least trying to make this a little better, but it shows that people are not going out and buying it on their own.
I'm sorry
not enough to keep the price up.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Ian. I wish you were in the studio here. We just had some Papa John's pizza delivered for lunch. Okay, not really.
They were
texting me these coupons. I took advantage of it. And no, there's another story in CNET, maybe my favorite, is about this guy suing Papa John's because they just keep texting him.
Yeah, and this is the thing about marketing, right? I mean, it's the advertising apocalypse, right? You keep getting text messages of all these things. And so, yeah, this guy told it. Usually when you get these messages, they say at the end, reply stop to cancel.
Right.
Well, he did that, and they didn't stop. And so now he's suing them, and he wants to sue them for $500 for each additional text message they sent to him after he said stop.
He says he feels...
I would love that.
I know. He says he feels anxiety every time he sees Peyton Manning now.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And, you know, despite the kind of silly premise, the underlying argument makes a lot of sense, right? If you tell a legitimate company like Papa John's to stop sending you messages, the law says you got to stop.
Right.
And the FTC has a website devoted to this issue. And so the fact that they didn't, this guy, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in court. My guess is that it's going to probably go at least a little bit in his way.
Yeah, maybe not $500 a pop. Maybe not $500 a pop, but he'll do okay. Ian Scher writes for CNET.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us this week, Ian. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Elise Glink is in the studio. Elise is the publisher of thinklink.com, CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for business. Elise Glink, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Nice to be here, Steve.
All right, so how's your 401k looking these days?
It's looking awesome. I'm so excited.
I was joking yesterday, you know, and I kind of got busted. I busted myself, but, you know, it's like going back to the 90s where you check your shares every day or your...
We're all geniuses.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. We're all investing geniuses now.
So every day I go back and I check my 401k, and then I heard someone say, and this used to be my song, it's like, well, it's great if we're doing all this pro-business stuff, but, you know, does this pro-business legislation or activity trickle down to the workers with higher pay? And that hasn't happened as much as it should have over the past 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, not so much. Their incomes are a little bit shy, although they've gone up a bit, which is nice. But everybody's 401k, boy, that has really zoomed through the roof.
But that's the thing, right? Because you're
crazy.
Chasing stock value.
Yep.
So you're not necessarily spending that money in investment or on your workers.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You're doing buybacks and things like that.
Right. I mean, I think there's some of that going on. I also think there's some real irrational exuberance in the marketplace where, you know, to coin a phrase, I didn't actually.
You look just like, no, you don't.
No. No, I don't look like him. You know, it's interesting to me. I get this question often. Steve Cochran will ask me about every 2 minutes, you know, what do I think everybody should do with their money? And I'll tell you what I'm doing with my money. I'm forgetting about it because this to me just feels like fake money. I'm really excited that it's there and maybe it'll keep going up. But none of my 401k, I'm not going to touch any of it probably for 20 or 30 more years. And so whatever happens now, and I do think we're going to, you know, fall off a cliff at some point in time and then we'll come back up again. I don't want to care so much about it. I don't want to look at it. In fact, I looked for the first time about 3 or 4 months ago at the end of the year, getting to the end of the year, realized that I was just fine, and I just promptly forgot again.
I'm sorry. Can you? I wasn't listening. I was checking my 401k.
Steve, you have a problem. We can talk about
okay,
that.
Okay, but there's no problem with if you know you're not going to touch it, it's going to stay there. Mm-hmm. You're reasonable or rational about it with enjoying the ride a little bit.
I am enjoying the ride, but I'm...
You think there's going to be a big bump at the end of the ride.
I do.
Why?
I do, because I look at, from an economic standpoint, and I'm an armchair economic person just like, you know, everybody else in the world, but I look at the idea that you're going to cut taxes, increase military spending, gut social programs except for supposedly Social Security and Medicare. You're going to take Medicaid and turn that back to the states in the form of block grants. And you're cutting taxes. I don't understand, just even on the back of an envelope calculation, how that's supposed to work. And by the way, we had this little quiz before we went on the air. The Fed has like $4.5 trillion with a T on their balance sheet, and they have to unwind that. And so I'm just wondering how all of those pieces fit in the same jigsaw puzzle.
Explain that for me, unwinding it and the impact on all of that.
So you probably remember I would come on the radio and talk about how the Fed was buying mortgage-backed securities in order to stabilize the bond market. And they bought billions and billions of dollars of it. And we called it things like the QE1 and the QE2, right? Quantitative easing. Everybody's like, oh, you mean Queen Elizabeth?
Right,
and we're
exactly.
Like, yeah, no. So all of those added up. And they're there, and they've been replacing them. They haven't added new chunks, but they've replaced the ones that the bonds that have been paid off and retired. And now they have to unwind that, meaning they're not going to buy as much, which potentially could send interest rates soaring.
Right. Okay. So this is clearly what you're saying is it's just being prepared for the fact that it's not all going to be. I mean, the track that we're on right now is not going to be. It's inevitable. We can't stay on this track.
Well, I don't know which part is smoke and which part is mirrors.
Right.
But I do think that at some point in time, the rubber, I hate to just do one cliche after another, but the rubber's going to hit the road, and we're going to actually have to see if Republicans in Congress can lower taxes and increase government spending and do it all in the same year.
GDP last year was what, 1.9%?
So GDP overall was just shy of 2%, but we did see tremendous growth in the revision in the third quarter. That was 3.5%. I had a number that actually surprised me. That's the highest and best it's been in a long time, and I think it got subsumed by all the other news going on this week. They do think that the fourth quarter, which was 1.9%, will be revised up, maybe over 2. So all that says is Donald Trump inherited a heck of an economy on January 18th. And we have to see what he does with that. I mean, you're at almost at record low unemployment levels, so I don't know where he's going to get the people to be employed from. We'll see.
Well, I hope he can find a way to make it work.
I do because I do want to go back and look at my 401k, and you're looking at it again.
I did.
Well, did it tick up again?
A little bit, yeah. Even though the market's down today, I just went up a little.
You know, it's funny.
How about that?
Consumer confidence is really high, and everybody just sort of goes, oh, the stock market's up. By the way, the Dow Jones is like 30 companies. But
I know.
30 companies are up. I feel great.
How did that happen? We're out of time.
But of course we are.
How is it that we've become so focused on the Dow and not the S&P, which is a broader indicator?
I don't know. The S&P is also kind of a crazy look because it's the biggest 500 companies. But at least 500 is better than 30.
Right.
Right?
Elise Glink, thanks very much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Hey, pleasure.
Elise Glink is the publisher of ThinkGeek.com and the CEO of Best Money Moves, an HR app for business. How's Best Money Moves going for you?
Oh, it's terrific. We just did another sale this morning.
Check it all out. ThinkGeek.com.